welcome to today's Experimenter Salon. My name is William Fowler, and I've contributed to the Experimenter section of the London Film Festival this year. I'm very pleased that we have filmmakers and artists with us today. We're going to have a chat, and there'll be a chance to ask some questions. It's going to be quite informal, so we'll talk chat for a while, and then we'll open it up. The artists we have today representing Anya Kirshner, whose film Moderation shows on Saturday evening, so that's still to come. It's at 8:15. Definitely do come to that if it's not already sold out. I imagine it may well be. So, and then representing in the future, the Eight from the Finest Porcelain, we have Larissa Sansar and Lauren Send, and the two works under discussion. Explore moderation kind of works and ask questions around the horror film genre. In the future state from the Finest Porcelain kind of riffs on themes around science fiction within a broadly sort of political context. So could we just sort of start, perhaps with you two, just say a bit about the background to the film, which screened last Friday, wasn't it? So people have had a chance to have seen the work. If you could begin with just saying a bit about the background to the film and perhaps... you know, perhaps how your interest in genre developed, and if indeed you think of it in those terms, whether by working with the sort of science fiction things?
Well, we kind of always work together. Soren usually writes the script, and my background is visual arts, but somehow I always make film, and Soren kind of writes the scripts. But before that, I used to make a kind of more direct documentaries about what's happening in Palestine.
Okay.
And so what I recently started doing in my work is find a way of contextualizing Middle Eastern politics in a completely different way.
Okay.
And I feel that my work started becoming more and more surreal, but I feel that the situation in Palestine is so surreal that it's quite hard to really talk about it in a very direct way. So I just felt that it was actually becoming... It was more honest to talk about in a more fictional way.
Mm-hmm.
I think hence the sci-fi direction. And in the last three films, we worked on those films together since 2009. And the film that I'm showing here is almost like the third film of a trilogy that we made together. The first one... shows the first Palestinian astronaut landing on the moon and planting the Palestinian flag on the moon. And the second one imagines the future of the entire Palestinian state in one high skyscraper.
Mm.
And the third one is a bit more kind of elaborate and complicated. There's a lot of script in it, so it's kind of veers away from the usual kind of much more visual direction that I had. It's about finding a way of changing the historical and political narrative that's going on in Palestine right now. So it's kind of like we're competing on narrative. But I don't think that. I think when the situation has become so. It has reached such a stalemate in Middle Eastern politics that sometimes it just seems that it's not really that the fact that the world doesn't understand what's happening. It's more that we have two forces that are competing on delivering a narrative, and in this film, the hero of the film wants to change that narrative.
Well, I noticed that she calls herself a narrative terrorist.
Exactly.
Comes a term that's used in that. And how has it been working together, sort of with those kind of ideas and this, working from perhaps a more visual approach to this more sort of script-based work, as you said?
I mean, that's been very interesting. We started with quite almost sided films based on a soundtrack only, so they were very visually conceived, and then with working with the same musician throughout these three past films. And we developed from wanting to depict, the first one was a riff of Stanley Kubrick's Space Odyssey.
Mm.
conquering that whole first American on the moon and passing it off as a Palestinian accomplishment, but really just with a soundtrack. And the second one was the same, but really unveiling just this piece of architecture, housing an entire population. So 3 million people in one giant structure. So it was like revealing various chapters, the lobby, the floors, how each floor has the monuments from real life Palestine replicated inside the lobbies for that feeling of homeliness.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, it's also a very silent film. We have some elevator ads and stuff like that that come with a bit of information, but otherwise quite silent and musical. And then the idea for this new film came actually from that Nation of State, as it was called, the film. In this designer skyscraper, they they have designer crockery as well, like designer plates with the Palestinian keffiyeh, some resistance symbol, also to sort of to play identity politics there. And we decided eventually, after having that, we got into the very idea of archaeology as warfare, namely that, you know, I mean, archaeology has always been a national sport in Israel-Palestine. It's the only place that I know of that has breaking news in archaeology on their front page newspapers. And it's always been a matter of establishing that national identity from early on. So if you establish a national identity and archaeology supports it, then whatever narrative you've spun on anything becomes true by default. So
well, it's a mythic narrative used to inform current realities or future.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if your narrative that sort of predates the state 3,000 years back into history is verified by a piece of crockery in the ground, then all of a sudden you have the idea of historical entitlement to that land completely justified. So we thought, well, from that nation state building, we have already the crockery. And if the idea of archaeology being as warfare is that, well, you shape your own narrative to fit your own ends, and then you dig in the ground to support that narrative, then you really reverse the idea of archaeology in the sense that you dig, and the story about the object you found has already been told. We can do that too, and create our own myth, and then deposit porcelain for future archaeologists to excavate. And that was an idea that developed, and we realized that it was, and then what we started working, like we did with the previous projects also, with Larissa doing visuals and us coming up with the outline. I go away and do a script that then was more wordy this time, and then we switch, and 17 rewrites later we did the film.
Did you find that, I mean, you said that how science fiction was a way of in some way addressing the kind of surrealism, as you put it, of the situation. I mean, was there also perhaps a way of addressing a controversial political issue through using this as a kind of another means that would enable somehow the film to be made or supported, or it would change its sort of journey through sort of exhibition possibilities and context, or just for how it might be received? Do you see what I mean?
Possibly, but I didn't choose the sci-fi approach because I wanted to kind of get the funding. And
no, I'm not suggesting that, sorry.
No, it wasn't difficult to kind of get the funding because of the political message, if that's the... obviously it's... because it's political, it's sometimes, I think, necessary for an artist to find a different way of talking about it than a politician.
Mm.
Because there are so many layers to the debate that kind of get lost, or the emotional level of what really happens to the people who are, say, under occupation is not really ever, doesn't come through when you're talking about, when you're just watching the news.
Mm.
So it's kind of important to find a different medium by which you can tell the same story. And even though it seems so surreal, it's all just based on what's happening in present-day Palestine. It's just a different way of approaching it.
Yeah.
And as we always talk about also with the science fiction part, that it's really more about the fiction than the science part, in the sense that it's really about highlighting the fact that fictionalization doesn't necessarily mean that you cannot apply to reality afterwards, in the sense that you need that refuge, not just as a sort of a narrative device to illustrate certain mechanisms of occupation or whatever, but actually it's out here that the narrative that then gets applied gets formed. So that's more important. And also, science fiction does one thing for the Palestinian predicament that works really well, in the sense that what's absent in Palestine is really a present tense. You linger towards the past and towards the future, ambitions for a state versus, you know, mourning of the lost land. So the present is always suspended, in a sense, which lends itself well to being talked about in a futuristic setting.
Yeah, so fictions, or so-called fictions and so-called realities, having kind of complex dialogues. Anya, could you sort of tell us a bit about the background to your film? And I know that you've been interested in exploring genre in various ways for a while in previous works. If it was perhaps more explicit in some ways in this one, it feels like with the almost you asking questions about what a horror film is and what, how horror genres even work. So it feels like you're really investigating quite pointedly. So perhaps tell us a bit about the general genesis of the project, and again, maybe your interest in genre more broadly.
I mean, all my previous films and also the films that I made together with David Panos in the past, they all to some extent started from a particular idea or something we wanted to cover, but then there was always very soon a decision to kind of find a genre to do that in.
Right.
So I think my whole kind of thought process somehow seems to, for some reason or another, very related to, you know, coming up with, like, starting to understand what I want to make a film about, but then also immediately going, hang on, what's the right genre for this? Almost like a painter would say, which palette would I choose or something. And I think that came generally from an ambition towards cinema, but without really wanting to participate in a kind of mainstream cinema.
Okay.
What genre offers generally, I think, is that it gives you a kind of pop cultural basis of kind of shared knowledge about a film prior to even seeing it. And somehow, I mean, obviously, it's very broadly speaking, but each genre seems to sort of be particularly good at dealing with a particular type of problem or a story or something. So some of the films, for example, from the past was also kind of using sci-fi to talk about the present and kind of an impasse. There is another film that was a Western, which very much deals with the gentrification and loss of land, and the Western with this idea of the frontier and the kind of expansion, and the kind of, you know, this kind of the way that in Westerns conflicts always seem to be fought over land and who got there first and who's going to build the railway. That made it very kind of, you know, appropriate somehow to use. So somehow in my career, I guess I've gone through working with sort of soap opera, sci-fi, Western, costume drama, historical, kind of more like a more historical kind of, not exactly reconstructions, maybe the wrong word, but let's say that. And somehow now with moderation, there was this idea to make a horror movie, but it got maybe even more invested in kind of research. So it's like not just the film exists obviously as a feature length film, but then it also in the whole development period and now also afterwards, it went through a series of events and symposias and workshops that are organized and that are also invited like other thinkers and writers to. So it was maybe like the most intense engagement
right.
I've had with the genre in terms of what it might be able to do, not just for the topic I wanted to talk about, but maybe in this case also for the first time having a topic that I couldn't quite fathom yet. So even though I think all the films that I've made were some way of working through a problem or a question or a set of questions that I didn't quite understand, the earlier films were more didactic. They had more opinions about, you know, and kind of clear ideas that they wanted to convey about, you know, what was going on. Whereas this film, like, genuinely, probably, like, you, and that sounds also kind of, I'm really glad that we're talking together, because I think there's loads of points of, you know, connection. There's a sense that, you know, sometimes you just end up with a problem that is so big, you know, like you say, this kind of conflict of narratives that, you know, that you just, you have to make something in order to think through it, at least in my case. And horror seemed to me the genre per se to deal with this type of impasse. So, because it's definitely the kind of moment where something has to transform really radically, and where the whole liminality of life and death and, you know, what is a subjectivity or a consciousness, like all these things get subverted. And it's also like an incredibly visceral experience, very, very effective, and something that I always found really hard to deal with, actually, as a kind of, as a genre in itself. I'm not a horror fan. There were a lot of films that I watched and I wanted to watch in the research, but I was really struggling with it too. So so I guess it comes back to
if you weren't a horror fan, and no saying you should or shouldn't be, but perhaps what, this may be a really difficult question to answer, but is a, can you sort of pinpoint your, perhaps where your interest in genre or horror, even the horror genre specifically, kind of comes from? Is it just, like, is it about engaging with popular forms, or is it a kind of almost like cinematic inquiry, like kind of trying to understand?
In this case, neither. I think it was really a kind of question about where you reground a different kind of ethics.
Okay.
And how you deal with that once you've all the kind of more available narratives seem exhausted.
Okay.
So I think question of, like, political, like, collapse of orders and kind of rational politics, let's say. So I think one of the earliest things that got me interested was Reza Negarestani's Cyclonopedia, which is a novel that deals with the Middle East as a kind of sentient entity and tries to, you know, kind of understand, like, he refers to this idea of, I think, something that he calls the ultimately messed up space. And sort of via Foucault, he ends up with this idea that at a certain point in a kind of conflict, civil war, colonial kind of nexus, things get so messed up that the common ground for things cannot be found anymore.
Mm.
He talks about Foucault's Chinese encyclopedia in that relation, where, you know, the same, I don't know if people know that, but it's a kind of description of a encyclopedia with animals in categories like animals with wings, animals that have knocked over the water pitcher, animals that look like, you know, dots from a distance or something. So you realize that actually, how would you even start putting things in categories? And then Foucault uses that about, like, trying to talk about this collapse of the sensible and the kind of the communicable.
It's interesting, there's a sort of point of connection between both your works of, like, using something that's, like, genre being something that's in some way defined or at least known. There's a sense of what we think we have an understanding of genre, and yet perhaps for both your works, it's become a way of kind of tackling or addressing that's kind of unknown or difficult to kind of articulate in some way, or address a problem or something that, I mean, I don't want to speak for you, but that's sort of resonates a little bit from what has been said.
I'm not a sci-fi fan.
This is other things, isn't it?
I'm a horror fan.
Okay.
Not a sci-fi.
Okay.
Next film, I should do horror.
Yeah.
I've never watched Star Wars even.
But
the entire team that we work with are complete sci-fi fans.
Okay.
And they get excited about spaceships, and so it's nothing that we, you know, we're discussing. But I think that. I use the genre in the sense that it kind of approximates Middle Eastern politics to an audience that it kind of brings it closer to various audiences, much more universal.
Mm.
It's also kind of a comment on just in general our culture, what we the signifiers that we have, what we get influenced by.
Mm.
So it's very hard to kind of keep, kind of stay in your intellectual bubble when you come from a certain background and not really realize that actually the world is completely influenced, even if you don't want to, you're influenced by pop and film.
Yeah.
And I think film, maybe what fascinates me by film is the fact that it empowers a nation. Because we all know about Americans, but I think we all know about that because we watch them, we're bombarded by American films. And I think that kind of, no matter what the American politics are, you're always drawn to, or you sympathize with Americans because you feel that they're close, you know who they are, you know how they live, even if you've never been there, even if you've never set foot in America.
Mm.
And somehow I feel that's the power of film. And maybe somebody who comes from Palestine, where it's just, you're an alien in the world, you're just, you're scary, you're Middle Eastern, for me, it is quite important to use something that's, first of all, disarming. And also it's more informative than, instead of you being the subject of, say, the news, you actually take on this power. You claim that right to make films and fiction, not documentaries, not be subjects of documentaries. And it shifts the power balance, I think.
Mm.
So for me, that's maybe at the heart of why I use these genres or comment on a more universal kind of form.
All of a sudden thought, you saying that you did soap opera and stuff like that before as well. I'm just realizing that. I mean, all your small films have been like that. Well, you did horror. You did soap opera.
Oh, yeah,
it's
true.
Yeah, I was just realizing. We've been doing all of these things like over the years. I was just realizing when you're talking that maybe it is not necessarily an embrace of those forms or those expressions or that pop cultural segment or whatever it is, but more the constant battle with the academic bubble, as you were saying, that this antithesis, these like dichotomies and says that instead of resorting to and sticking to the accepted forms of representation of political conflict, whether it be this part of academia, that part of academia, or this documentary sort of approach, or whatever it is, then embracing those other ones and actually sort of communicating in a different way the very same conflict in a different way, but also in a sense dealing with negotiating the expected approach, because that's been a recurring pattern also in Lewis's career, this constant sort of reference to the, well, but when you're, the sense of loyalty towards a topic, like a certain topic lends itself or comes with a set of expectations, an expected loyalty towards the documentary form or the essay form or the journalistic form or whatever it is. Whereas Lewis, from early on, decided to embrace, I mean, some of the first films were spaghetti western, soap opera, that kind of thing, which of course is also a comment on existing approaches. That all those were conceived like very handheld at a time when the most accepted form was the documentary form, the very valid documentary form, because that was a very important approach as well. But there was constantly throughout Lewis's career this conflict between expectations, not only from audiences, but also specifically maybe even from curators, who wanted a specific type of handheld documentary work, because this is accepted documentation of this particular, or even artistic approach to this particular topic. And instead of sort of accepting that curatorial dictum, in a sense, I think Larissa just took it one step further and said, no, I'll go more glossy and I'll go sci-fi and I'll stick to it.
No, I think that's why it's so important for me to do very high productions, because I just want to kind of break the cliche of what an artist has to kind of produce, or what, on top of this, a Middle Eastern artist has to produce. The form is quite important.
And how has that been, sort of, you know, I suppose, at least in the UK, historically, you know, artist experimental film has been about perhaps resisting narrative and, resisting techniques that involve kind of seduction or music that are kind of mood affecting. But I think, obviously, you know, both works are, you know, going there and going with narrative. We talked about, you know, narrative terrorism, and you know, your bio, you talk about being, you know, you describe your works very overtly as narratives. I mean, how have you sort of reflected on that historical relationship and what it means to be, well, I mean, I don't know if you think of yourself as an artist filmmaker or not, but, you know, that the kind of different spheres and perhaps certain types of tendencies that have been historically passed down.
I mean, I always thought it was a really weird ideological argument to call, like, kind of structuralist filmmaking or whatever kind of sort of neutral, just because it didn't have music, or it didn't have, I mean, I kind of, I watched an Ernie Ger work or work by Liz Rhodes, and I have a really strong emotional response, like I might have even to a narrative, or I watch, you know, big Hollywood special effects, and that would be the only thing of the film that I'm interested in, but I'm watching them like an artist's work or something. I mean, I always thought this kind of idea that narrative per se was sort of manipulative, and non-narrative was progressive in some way and neutral, was very, very strange, kind of maybe also a sort of inheritance of a modernist over reliance on rational kind of organization of things, and the kind of, you know, sort of, you know, I don't think, like, neither of these things, they're heavily political. They just function in very different ways. So I think the rejection of maybe a lot of what was kind of traditionally in the UK more kind of put forward as what an artist's film should look like, was also a kind of, and I think, you know, there's works that cross over, so I think actually even like Liz Rhodes is a really interesting example for someone who's sort of manages to do both, but I just didn't buy it, so there was a kind of desire to I mean, it's not that I'm following a narrative that is a kind of conventional three-act structure or something like that, but I've always thought that one of the strong points of, like, a kind of watching a film would be that you would be very stimulated effectively, and there would be some transfer of kind of elements of a relatable experience, let's say. So. And that doesn't mean that I prefer narrative films to non-narrative films, or that, you know, it just happens in my own practice that this is it. But I think the way it's talked about is fundamentally, like, people are not questioning their own prejudice about that. And I think that people, like, I mean, for me, obviously, that was, like, Derek Jarman was a big discovery during art school. So I think I do believe that there were certain practitioners that always were in that line and in that tradition. And also, like, you know, if you talk about, yeah, spaghetti western or even soap opera, they were always genres where actually quite a lot of, people that were having unusual and very politicized kind of practices ended up working in, you know. So I think there is a lot of, I mean, even in South America, there's a lot of artists, kind of filmmakers, people more from that ended up in at some point kind of politicized soap opera making or like all these kind of things. Like Kobuchi has a very strong kind of left background, very grounded in this 70s Italian movement. So I think that it's more about finding a better narrative also, how we narrate the legacies and the kind of genealogies of the kind of films we're making.
Well, I mean, I like a lot of genre movies, and I think there's lots of really fascinating, really interesting horror movies and science fiction movies, and it's really easy to kind of just say certain types of films are all a certain way or have certain politics. Or I mean, you've sort of both talked about, all three of you talked about different types of language and maybe different audiences or kind of, I guess, relationships to popular culture. And I'm just sort of curious how you thought about the context in which these works are seen. So how do you feel about them being presented like alongside other examples of that genre or things that are, you know, works in that genre? And I'm sort of interested in, particularly with moderation, because we haven't talked about this yet, but you've directly involved actors who've previously been in horror movies and they haven't actually... What's been curious, I noticed, is that in your own writing about the film, you haven't actually highlighted that at all, as far as I've seen. But yet, horror fans would be really like, oh my God, that, you know, the guy from this cannibal film is in your film. I can't believe that. But yeah. You've chosen not to do that, which is quite, you know, which is interesting.
Well, I would probably have written it if I had more space in the synopsis.
Sure.
and it's also, like, to be honest, I mean, I think what got me interested in horror was Andrzej Zulawski, actually.
Right. Yeah.
And what I found really powerful about Andrzej Zulawski was that precisely he could kind of join a kind of horror narrative to a political, to a love, erotic kind of narrative and really open up the way that these three areas that are usually divided into different genres and different forms of our thinking and discourses are kind of fused and constantly actually impinge on each other in the way things really happen. But the question was really, does this work? You know, is it really like this? This would still be my questions the first time that I've just used a genre and said, should this genre kind of live or die? Can we talk about things in this genre in a way that will get us over kind of impasse? So I've tried to send the film, I mean, I've submitted the film to horror film festivals. I would love, like, a horror fan to go and go, like, what the fuck? and generally, I'm really, like, with all the films, there is a sort of openness where they would go and what they could do in different contexts. It's almost an experiment. So, but in this case, it hasn't, so far, no horror film festival wanted it. So, yeah.
I mean, it definitely, I think it does work in those terms. But I mean, in terms of genre, curiously, horror specifically, there is almost a mini genre of meta horror films. So, like Quadlock Vampire by Pierre Portabella. There's a strange... cinema verite style film called Demon Lover Diary, and I can't remember who made it. It's on Vimeo. It's really interesting, but they're following the production of a horror film, but it's a kind of cinema verite thing, and they get very caught up with the relationship, and they're quite unstable characters, and then bits would start to get a bit fictional. Anyway, so there's a bit of a, it's curious that, unless it's just other things I don't know about, it seems like horror particularly seems to lend itself to this kind of meta-narrative stuff, and there is like, maybe calling it a genre is too overblown, but there is this tradition or something.
Yeah.
Which is, so people are kind of interested in posing questions about it, I think. So there's a sort of lineage of sorts. How about how many your film being presented, you know, say, would you submit to a sci-fi film festival?
Yeah, I think we even won an award at the sci-fi.
Fantastic.
In Abu Dhabi, no?
That wasn't a sci-fi, that was a science.
Okay, so yeah, I was wrong. What is a science?
Science fiction. But we are in science fiction film festivals.
Great.
Yeah, yeah. That's fine.
Yeah.
That's nice. Mm. I mean, it's funny with every film that we've done, all of a sudden there's this added bonus of all of a sudden reaching into new territory, and we see a lot of sort of interest from sci-fi fans.
Mm.
All of a sudden, a lot of things like that, or a lot of offers are coming in from, yeah.
I mean, sort of, I think in terms of arts filmmaking, this feels like a kind of, you know, we're shining a light on it today, it's become perhaps more of a concern. You know, Ben Rivers' film, you know, Ben Rivers has worked in this way as well, and yet I do feel like there's a broader interest for kind of hybrid forms that goes beyond arts filmmaking. Like, sort of generally, there's a kind of interest in exploring interrelationships and kind of pulling apart things more as part of doing that. One thing I wanted to ask both of you specifically was, you know, we're sort of saying how there's this thing about horror and meta horror, but with science fiction, there's, you know, the kind of codes of what science fiction filmmaking is a little bit different, and perhaps it sits more comfortably on genre across kind of different forms. So science fiction is actually about writing as well. So in some way, you know, science fiction writing looms kind of larger, or as large, or maybe larger than sci-fi films, possibly.
Mm-hmm.
It depends who you're talking to, maybe. And obviously, you're a writer yourself. You know, that's as I understand it, that's what you do a lot of
yeah.
the time. And I wondered if that, you know, we've been talking about filmmaking and kind of, you know, we could talk more about kind of codes and in terms of genre. But is there anything about actual writing? And is, you know, do you feel like that's actually a slightly different palette to draw upon, or is there? You said you hadn't watched Star Wars, so it's kind of different references, perhaps.
Well, I think we worked in a very, we finally found a way of working together where we don't have to work at the same time. So I work on visuals and Sam works on the writing, and we work separately, and then we kind of look at what each of us did, and then we kind of get a, respond to Sans writing and with visuals, and he responds to my visuals with more writing. So we kind of build up like this. So in that sense, I'm sure it's different from when you're writing your own novel, because it's I think what we struggled with in the last film is how to give both script and visuals the same weight, because sometimes I think when you the writing could really kind of overcome or overrule all the visuals because it's so straightforward. Like when with writing, there's a rationality that comes with it, and it's so straightforward that it could kind of influence the visuals. It could kind of let you know.
Is that what's illustrating what or what has dominated?
Exactly.
So I found myself thinking about this quite a lot when I was watching your film, actually, and how it works in those terms. So
we didn't want to the visuals to illustrate the writing, nor the writing to illustrate the visuals. So, and I think we thought that what would really make a good piece of work is if we actually find a way of giving both a voice and somehow making them work together.
Mm.
So that's why I think we rewrote the scripts and the visuals. I redid the visuals 17 times.
Mainly to pull them apart, right? I mean, there's a couple of places only where the visual... I mean, the good thing is that Larissa has this highly imaginative way of working with visuals. So, like, in the beginning, it was thought of as a video essay. It's supposed to be sort of a journalist interviewing this narrative rebel leader and on a piece of found audio somewhere. So we're supposed to basically just have it was supposed to be sort of a fictional video essay, so a very rational argument about why this is important historically, futuristically, and academically. And then Larissa started, from me having that basic setup, like a dialogue form, where we agreed on the basic ideas, Larissa took it and went for it in a way that I had never imagined, which was great, because then a couple of her initial visuals made it clear that we were in sort of dream fantasy territory rather than academic video essay here. And so I guess that that's another amusing thing, talking about the genre approach here, that sci-fi really came later than just knowing that the kind of visuals that we wanted to have a support for the main argument had to be CGI based, because otherwise we couldn't get there in grandeur, basically. So it's more or less, like, if you look at the film, it's composed of 31 scenes, and I think three of them have spaceships, and that's really your sci-fi signifier. The rest of it is just talking about the future, and that doesn't make for, you know, I mean, that's the thing. Very, very few things actually make up that whole genre.
I was thinking
genre.
Sound is curiously, I mean, it's maybe sound design and music can be quite a sort of genre signifier in a way, and maybe, so I think the sound design of your work has the kind of sparseness, but a kind of an atmosphere, and then I think in moderation, it's perhaps different, but the kind of main musical refrain, yeah, I mean, it's newly composed work, but at the same time, sort of feeling like it referencing certain kind of horrors of genre tropes, horror music genre tropes, so these kind of more, sometimes pushing to the fore, but also being quite subtle, kind of placing things and kind of, you know, working, kind of commenting, whilst also leading the viewer a little bit as well. I mean, how you work with a musician or with a...
Yeah, I worked with Dracula Lewis, which seemed like the amazing, the perfect name. And he's from Italy, and he's a musician. I heard, I went to several gigs, and then I was a huge fan. And then I was like, I really kind of, as soon as I heard it, I was like, I want this music for this film. So I approached him to see if we could, if he could make an original soundtrack for me, and then we kind of just like he gave me several options. He gave me literally, like, because he works a lot also with samples, and his music is very cinematic also a lot of the time. There's like kind of more like soundscapes or something, so and samples from films and also like Italian film, like, it had already all this, so it was kind of like finding something almost like perfect already where and then he gave me just different options to go in a more Argento goblin, to go into a more Carpenter or whatever, like, direction, and we did that very consciously. And then I had a second, I knew that I wanted to use the Cold Song by Purcell in the film, and that it was very hard to use because there was this very well-known version by Klaus Nomi that probably a lot of people know, and that's very definitive kind of, and I found another Italian composer to make a sort of almost like a giallo version of that, but we kept it very much within the idiom of like the horror film music. I mean, I think this was a great thing, like someone actually described it, like someone wrote a review and it called it a horror movie without horror, which I really like. I think it should be almost the tagline for the film somewhere. what was I going to say now? So there are certain things that work really well in genre films. And another thing that I really loved about horror was this kind of camera that tends to glide around a house, that kind of embodies usually the evil presence coming to, you know, whatever. Just kind of somehow, I guess this is like the artist's kind of instinct or something. I was really fascinated just in using that, but without it necessarily signifying. Like, I really like the idea that the camera would function in this film as its own entity. And that it would sort of be sentient or have a sort of consciousness that would allow it to go around and look at things. But then I used that less to build up this idea of like, the evil is coming or something. But they used it more to actually explore the interior spaces, because if you go and see the film on Saturday, you will realize that the the three main actors that I worked with are all shot in their own homes. And somehow through getting to know them and developing the film, it was also really important to me what they had in their houses and to see this sort of more kind of cosmopolitan Mediterranean set of cultural references, but then also that would have like Japanese kind of fan or so, you know, that would crop again in someone else's house. There was all this kind of connection. So I think also this is kind of great when you have a set of like tools, but then you kind of just see what else they can do if you free them a little bit from the thing that they usually have to signify. And I thought, yeah, I thought in your film as well, that was very great, like, especially at the end. Like, I mean, it's a while ago now because I saw it in February, but I remember there was also this very strong feeling of ambiguity as to the sanity of the main protagonist, the narrative terrorist. And it kind of cast a whole new layer of, you know, the questions about the let's say, if this is a kind of practice of using archaeology towards kind of a nationalistic kind of project, then what would be, you know, what would be the kind of the raison d'être of replicating that? You know, why would you just, if it's a war, why fight exactly with the same weapon? And where is this character in relation to that? And is she actually, you know, like, is she like a hero, or is she almost like more borderline anti-hero? Or I was curious about that. I don't know. Maybe you can say a bit more about this.
It's supposed to be ambiguous. I mean, you don't know if she's being interviewed by a psychiatrist or by a journalist, by the Mossad, maybe. So it's all these things, and the timing, and the time is supposed to also be very confusing. You don't know if she's in the future, past, or... And I think it kind of is very much about what she's dealing with as a person who is really in a position where she's trying to change that narrative. To what extent is she willing to take that exercise without coming across as insane? I mean, how much of her practice is something that comes out of a trauma or a desperation rather than it maybe a kind of what you could say a normal way of reacting to something. So it is supposed to be kind of overdone, over dramatic, over quite insane. Yeah.
I think the ambiguity is also in this. It seems to be sort of a rationality, hers, a rationality run amok, in a sense. There's a logic that permeates her whole line of thinking, but eventually the rationality is sort of beyond, a step or two beyond reason, in a sense, which is why there are also, throughout the dialogue that she has with what we label her psychiatrist, a couple of small conflicts between them, where we're testing, constantly testing the sanity of this. Are you saying that? Are you really saying that? But haven't you said that before? This kind of conflict where she recedes, she sort of retracts back into her shell and doesn't really know how to assess. And also there's a cyclicality to the whole piece, in the sense that it starts by repeating a dream sequence of porcelain falling from the sky. And it actually ends up by repeating that very same dream sequence. So it seems also that the interview situation is something, it takes the form of a repeated sort of assessment, psychological assessment, or an interrogation where we're trying to find flaws in your... And I guess the idea is also that, once again, it's some kind of stab at... We always pictured this person to be, this rebel leader to be an ex-academic that had enough of all the writing and the publications in closed circuit, and just wanted to go out and and triggered possibly by the loss of her sister that plays a great part in the film as a narrative device, also for accentuating the idea of not just national but also personal loss. So the sister, the lost sister that appears as a sort of as a historical remnant and also sort of symbolizes her attempt to sort of renegotiate and reconnect with the past. I mean, that whole strain also is something that puts her sanity to the test. So there is an ambiguity as to whether or not she is just out there good or out there very, very bad, in a sense. So yeah, and is she on that note a lost hero or an actual sort of up-and-coming star of local narrative history?
I think that's something that both works share, is this kind of exploration of the subjective and the objective, or that they're both kind of under investigation, or like where one stops and one starts, they're kind of both being kind of searched through or explored amongst kind of a whole myriad of other questions as well, I think. I have a sort of, there are other things to talk about, but I wanted to open it up to the audience as we've been chatting for a little while. Does anyone have a question or sort of a comment on either the films or the filmmakers or even just the subject at hand? Yeah.
Hi, I have some questions about the liberation movement, the women's production.
In Greece? I've been living there for 5 years. So it was the second film that I made there. And the amazing thing about Greece, working in Greece as a filmmaker, is that it's not a massive scene also of people that work in the industry. And then also a lot of people that work in the industry also tend to work in theater or are very close to the arts in general. So, and kind of like some of the most interesting directors of the last years, like someone like Hector Sligitzos, for example, who made The Boy That Eating the Bird Fruit, he comes from a cinema background and went No, he comes from the theater background, went into cinema, so there's a lot of kind of crossover. And I found that for the particular way I work, I found that really tremendously kind of, I mean, I made the first film there without an intention of staying there, but then it just sort of happened and I kind of felt like this is really a place where I have the people around me that I want to work with. It's a huge difference from London, where people are much more industry kind of streamlined into certain ways of thinking, and also the references that they will have, they will be quite specific to whatever their kind of specialist kind of, you know, thing is. So you spend a lot more, even though I always had great people to work with here as well, I had to look for them a really long time, and you still spend a lot of time explaining on set why you want something this way and not that way, if it's not the way that it's usually done or something. So I felt like in Greece there was, this was kind of less of an issue, and I felt I was more like, even the industry people I worked with, I all felt like they were more like artists. Yeah.
Hi. Thanks for such a great talk. I want to ask you guys regarding short films. What do you like, you know, doing genre films? Which, and for short film, do you consider releasing online, or do you prefer going via festival road? Because genre, especially, you have like huge fan base online, and you know, by running Kickstarter campaign and stuff, if you want to turn that into future film as well, that fan base is there to help you, you know, funding your process, you know, if they like it. And, you know, especially if your film is very visual, especially sci-fi, but there's a lot of gamers and stuff like that. And the fact that film festivals are usually more drama, they prefer more drama than genre things. So for short films about like 10 minute short films, 10 minutes long short films or like 7 minute long short films, do you still prefer going via festival route than releasing online?
I mean, we're bound by one particular thing. We always wanted to release online, specifically also the previous film, Nation Estate, because mainly because we felt it belonged kind of out there in the public domain, because it was an important political message, and also because at the time of doing the film we didn't have an exhibition set up in Palestine where we felt that it needed to be shown, and therefore releasing online would have been a great thing. And then our distributor signed a couple of contracts with television channels that prevented that. So that became a problem, and that is like a sad problem. It seems like an outdated problem, but it's still very much a problem in the sense that film festivals still want that premiere status, and if it's online, then all of a sudden you can wave goodbye to any kind of A festival, and you have to wait to the second wave of festivals, and it just becomes it's complicated. I think we're in the VHS Betamax sort of period of releasing online type thing. It should be possible because it needs to be out there. That's how you cultivate a fan base. But the festival legislations and the television contracts and whatever else you have contract-wise often do tend to prevent that, like a multifaceted release in a sense.
So if you're getting a television contract, is it like because still you constraining audience? I don't know, is it worth like signing that contract to releasing online if you have
no,
to balance it?
Possibly not.
Right.
No. It just still has a couple of years in it. That's the only problem.
Yeah, especially with the sci-fi, the majority of the story, like, you know, I've been hearing from Hollywood is like, especially Deadpool, it's a superhero film, which they did short film, which Universal Studios didn't agree to it, but they leaked online, and users started liking it. Everyone started liking it. They now released it, which is like still considerably less with the electronic 5 million budget, but they made like huge money out of it, like, you know, huge success, great story, everything, right? So do you, in the next film, you prefer like, you know, cutting down, okay, running for festivals and stuff like that for 6 months, 7 months,
yeah,
then releasing online?
Possibly. It would be nice to have a combo of all that where nothing sort of trips the other aspect of it. I mean, in our case, it's also, as we do, like with this appearing in an art context where like galleries involved and all that also want sort of a limited edition version, and that seems to conflict with the very idea of online availability. I mean, there's a lot of small fine-tuning on that whole structure that needs to benefit the films more than the individual sort of right holders. That would be nice, yeah.
Because there's an ongoing tension, isn't it, really? Some films, interestingly, John Smith is a very established filmmaker in this country, but his film, Girl Chewing Gum, I think you can watch it online, you can buy it on a DVD, you can rent it and also take modern owner copy in the collection.
Yeah.
So it's one of the few examples that kind of just crosses through, but that, you know, that's quite rare. I think you had a question. There's a mic.
Okay.
There's a mic coming. Even though you're very kind.
Just listen to what you're talking about with your political content within your films. I'm just curious if you ever come with any difficulty or like resistance to showing it in institutions because of its political content.
Well, in the previous film that I made, there was a big scandal, political scandal. Should I tell this? It's a very long story.
Sounds interesting.
I was nominated as one of 8 photographers for a prize that was run by a museum in Switzerland. And the sponsor for this museum was Lacoste, the clothing company. I never applied for this prize. I was just received a phone call out of the blue, and they nominated me for, and their theme that year was Joy of Life. And I completely got confused when I got this call, because, and I said, but you know my portfolio, if you're choosing me based on my work, that I have nothing to do with that. and they said that's really great, but... we want an ironic take on this because I don't want the direct, you know, interpretation of the theme. So okay, and I had this idea of, you know, representing the Palestinian, you know, the entire Palestinian population in one huge skyscraper as an ironic take on what would a future Palestinian state look like, because there's hardly any space left in for a Palestinian state to exist. And they thought that was an amazing, you know, take on the theme. And so they gave each photographer a bursary, small bursary, to do three sketches. And I think the winner would get, out of the eight competitors, I think the winner would get £20,000. So it's quite considerable to if you want to do a film. So I submitted those sketches, and they were very happy with them. And we were they were about to launch their eight photographers online with their work. And just the day before the launch, they called me again and said they have good news and bad news. The bad news is that Lacoste, somebody high up in Lacoste, decided that my work was too pro-Palestinian, and therefore they want to remove me completely from the list of artists, and that they tried as a museum, of course, they cannot just remove an artist, so they tried to negotiate with Lacoste, but they're so adamant, and therefore it's either me leaving the competition or they cancel the whole prize. And so I didn't have anything to really to say if they just, they're just basically telling me that's the way it's going to be. But they said that they're going to send me a contract the next day to, because obviously I'm not in the competition, so I have to sign a different contract. And the next day I received a contract saying that I left the competition to seek other opportunities.
You left the
according to my own
voluntarily to seek other opportunities.
Silent. This was a good. That was a good.
No, the good news. The good news was, the good news was that if you go along with signing this, we'll give you a solo show in about a year's time when this whole thing blows over.
So the whole thing just seemed like it just didn't look good for me at all, and the more they were bribing me with more, you know, good news, the more it, the more it just became impossible for me to stay silent. So I have a friend at the who works at the Independent, and she advised me to write a
press release,
and helped me write it. And so I told the museum that I cannot really be silent because it's just going to look completely bad for me. And they kind of wished me good luck. And I think because, you know, an artist is really so weak in these situations compared to Lacoste, you know. But the story just went completely crazy. In I think after we announced this at the Independent, maybe an hour later the BBC called. And it just, I think Sarah and I were answering phone calls, emails, 24 hours
straight. We had a war room set up.
I think we didn't change our clock. We woke up and we started, you know, answering phone calls. It was just, became completely mad. And I think after 48 hours, the museum called me and said, we have good news for real. that they decided to drop the sponsorship of Lacoste, and they're siding by the artist to side by artistic freedom of expression.
That they just saved themselves like this close to, because after 24 hours they released a statement. They said they shut down, like there were so many journalists calling Lacoste headquarters and the museum's headquarters all day that they shut their phone line.
Make a good film out of that.
Yeah. But they shut down their phone lines, and also their Facebook pages also got completely swamped. But after 24 hours, a first statement came out saying that there has been absolutely a complete misunderstanding. They stand side by side, Lacoste and the museum, and the artist's perception that there was any political censorship involved in this is out of proportion. So, please,
Oh, it's because I didn't comply didn't, with the theme, which was joy of life.
You was asked to vote.
Yeah.
So yeah, and then after that, I was called. I was even invited to the UN to speak about, because freedom of artistic expression is considered freedom of speech. When you think it's under that umbrella, so. It's quite interesting where these things take you, but and it's not the first time I get censored, but this was just so blatant, and the fact that the director of the museum told me himself that why I was censored, I think he told me too much. He shouldn't have.
Yeah, he regrets those few sound bites. Yeah.
Any other questions or comments?
I mean, I know it's good to record the conversations for posterity, but sometimes I think the microphone is an unnecessary kind of mediating device. Do you know what I mean? That kind of, it limits the
depends
democracy
the
of the conversation.
Yeah,
but anyway, I just would just like to ask Larissa and Soren to talk us a little bit more about the genesis of the project outside of the film element, because I know that. I hope you don't mind me asking about this, but I'm utterly fascinated by it, because you're actually also performing art actions in Palestine as part of the overall project. I just think that's really fantastic, and also, again, you know, you put yourselves out there and take risks because of what the work you make is really important politically. So it'd be really interesting to hear more about that.
I mean, sometimes I think because we're so used to working with Israel, Palestine, that we sometimes kind of think that, oh, it's risky, but nothing really happens. But this time, Soren, when he got back, told me that he was this close to a shooting when he was leaving the airport. And that's when it just you start realizing that this is scary. I mean, that's why when you leave the Israeli airport, a lot of times they confiscate your films. And you start realizing why art is potent. Otherwise, people were not going to be, you know, put in prisons for their work. So it is considered threatening for states to have artistic work that's tackling politics. But you just came on Sunday.
Yeah, maybe the genesis of the project is that it started as an idea for a performance where we wanted to take crates and crates of porcelain to Palestine and bury it throughout the country and then document that, and that would be the end of it. And we decided eventually that for sheer shipping reasons, maybe making a science fiction film would be easier. And so that took 2 years, and 2 years later we decided that maybe we should come full circle and actually carry out the act set forth by the narrative terrorists. And we did so by just making smaller deposits, symbolic deposits of porcelain, and mapping out like symbolic locations. First time was in April, I think, where I did six deposits in Palestine in relation with local art institutions. We facilitated something just inside the old city walls of Jerusalem, which was a very symbolic deposit. We buried 10 plates, sort of indicative of a family or something like this. A meter and a half into a community garden inside the old city on Israeli Independence Day, which made it quite both symbolically interesting but also quite scary in the sense that they're over patrolling the area on that day. And just on the city wall of Jerusalem, they're walking there with their machine guns. So we had to almost like find a break in there, or the gap between sort of before we did that. And the owner of the community, or the caretaker of the community garden, was also quite aware that we need to not get caught doing this, because archaeology is a potent national sport, and digging is too. Palestinians do not have as many permits to dig as their counterparts. So what they did in the community garden was to pretend to replant an olive tree. So they dug out an olive tree, put it over there and dug a deep hole there, and then we came, deposited the porcelain, they put the olive tree back, and we covered that up. We did that 6 times, and then we did another 9 times, 9 digs now, just last week, in relation to the biennial down there, Calandia International, documenting each dig, some of them now inside of Israel rather than in the West Bank and Jerusalem, but waterborne there, as I would be stopped immediately if I started digging holes in Haifa and Acre and stuff like that. And what we're doing with those deposits, symbolic as they are, I mean, we're taking down the coordinates and engraving them into small metal discs and inserting those metal discs into small replicas of the bombs that are used for porcelain distribution in the film, which again are based on an old Russian nuke from the Cold War, and making sort of a Fabergé egg out of a bomb. So whenever you lift up the lid of this thing that sits on its wingtips, like a 20-centimeter bronze sculpture, inside you see the coordinates in sort of a spacey font to the remote deposit of porcelain. And the whole project is called Archaeology in Absentia, which is a, sort of the culmination or the revisiting of the genesis of the entire project. So the idea is that any museum or collector that holds this bomb eventually becomes the sort of remote protector of a deposit of porcelain in Palestine.
And the collaborators get why you're doing what you're doing, because that's so much part of the,
yeah,
the discourse is so strong.
But down there, they really respond to that theme, knowing well what it means on a daily basis for the confiscation of more and more land.
And we got a lot of help. For example, we can't, and it's so hard to enter Gaza. I've never been myself. So we got a lot of help. We have help from the French Institute, who took some of the porcelain to bury in Gaza. But yeah, so we have a lot of people who actually took some porcelain to dig in various parts that we can't access.
And it's also in the spirit of the project itself that you have this collaborative effort, and you have venues agreeing to be part of this. Venues also historical, sort of Nazareth is inside of Israel, but has a very strong Palestinian significance. So we buried stuff there as well. And to have people sort of come around, help dig even, like to that effect, and witness this ceremonial burial is sort of in the spirit of the project as well, so yeah.
Sounds amazing.
Thanks.
And we're just sort of coming to the end now, but people had a chance to sort of ask a question, but I'm wondering if there was anything that any of you wanted to just kind of say around the things we've been talking about, which you perhaps have had a chance to do so from the chat so far. No pressure, just more an opportunity in case you had thoughts beforehand around the thing. But okay. Well, otherwise, moderation will be shown Saturday, so Anya will be present with Maya Levinsky, who's the sort of collaborator and actress in the film. So we'll be having a conversation then again as part of the screening, so do come and see the film. And for now, just join me in thanking the panel today.
Thank you.